I'm Lisa DeLay, and you're listening to the Spark My Muse podcast. Welcome, everybody, to Spark My Muse. Today, my guest is Dr. Leon Seltzer. He is a writer for Psychology Today, an author, and a psychologist with a general private practice for the last 30 years. Thank you so much, Dr. Seltzer, for being my guest today.
Happy to be here.
Today, we're going to discuss a topic that is rather common, but usually really hard to navigate, passive aggression. But before we get started, do you mind giving us a little bit of your background?
Actually, my background is curious because I was an English professor for over a decade before I went back to graduate school, got a second doctorate in psychology, and basically developed a private practice at the same time that I'm very interested in writing as I was as an English professor. So in writing for Psychology Today, which I've been doing online for the last 8+ years, I've written maybe 325 articles or so on a number of different topics. And one thing that I was interested in researching was passive aggression, because it's a very common phenomenon and a very difficult problem to treat.
Mm. And so it comes up quite a lot, I'm sure, in your private practice among like relationship problems and things like that, right?
Yes, it does.
And so if we're going to be defining it, it sounds like oxymoronic when we say passive aggressive. So how do you go about defining something like that for someone who's unfamiliar?
Well, I would distinguish it from aggressive behavior, which is basically acting against someone else. And because it's overt, the other person can appreciate that behavior as being aggressive, as being against them. But with passive aggression, it's nowhere as straightforward. It's like conveniently forgetting something. So when somebody says, well, you just didn't want to do it, and you say, well, no, I was quite ready and willing to do it, I just forgot, then it's hard to really confront them, because their denial just sort of gets them off the hook, even though you may have a sense that they're acting out something that they didn't want to do, or they're acting out some animosity that they might have toward you.
Hmm. Well, it seems like sometimes people who are doing passive aggressive things seem to be conscious of it, and other times maybe unconscious, like they might not have the guts to stand up to you, or and other times it seems more manipulative than that. But one of the things you had written is that passive aggression isn't a milder form. It's not milder than aggression. It's just an indirect form. And I thought that was a really incisive point, that it's not like I'm a nicer person, so I'm just passively doing this. It's just, it's harder to figure out what's going on.
That's true. And I think it's true because the passivity of the aggression is kind of a defense mechanism. It's like, you can't act against me because I'm not really acting against you, because it is devious. If you don't want to go somewhere with your spouse and you somehow miss the exit, or you're so late in getting ready that it's not even going to be viable to go, but you say, look, I didn't mean it, I just kind of lost sense of time or something like that, then you defend yourself against the other person's attacking you, while they may attack you otherwise, particularly if they suspect that you're acting out your dislike for going wherever you had planned to go or that you would agree to go. But the main thing is that it's important for the person who has a sense that the other person is being manipulative, or the other person is acting willfully against them, to basically smoke them out and say, look, I know you didn't want to go. And maybe you didn't want to tell me you didn't want to go, but I'm really disappointed, because my sense is somehow or other you contrived. You can deny it as much as you want, but my experience is that you contrived not for us to be able to go. And that's something we need to talk about. In other words, you really have to confront it. You have to do it in a way as I guess, graciously or as non-attackingly as possible, so you just don't get a straight-out denial. But again, if that's a defense that's been used over and over again, if it was learned all the way back in childhood, it's going to be hard to smoke them out.
Right. And the reason they're doing it is because they're not able to really do the thing you called the golden mean, which is maybe you can go into, I loved how you said that, expressing thoughts and feelings but giving respect and showing appreciation for another person's viewpoint. It's kind of like holding that tension of being assertive and respectful, but also not, running over someone else's feelings and thoughts and everything, but at the same time holding your own and confronting things when you have to. And it's hard if you're really afraid or if you've been raised in a environment that's very authoritarian or domineering, or you're not allowed to express your own feelings and things like that. So it's really hard to get, I've noticed just in my own life in my adult life, dealing with people who will send these little torpedo bombs at you and you're not sure, like, was I supposed to read their mind on that? Or was that like some weird manipulation thing? Or you're not ever quite sure, but if you would confront them, you think everything's going to be denied.
And if you confront them, by the way, you've just said a lot of excellent basic things. So I'm responding to the last thing you said, but at some point I'd like to respond to other things you said, because you were really getting at the distinction that needs to be made between effective, assertive behavior and how it can get rooted out and lead to either aggressive behavior or, in many cases, passive-aggressive behavior. But in terms of somebody's maybe sending you a torpedo bomb, it could be that they felt misunderstood by you. One reason that people misunderstand others is somehow or other they have a bias that has come from maybe they're being refused or denied or rejected in the past. So they read things into your message that you certainly hadn't intended. And if it seems like they're being vindictive or resentful, and you can't understand where it's coming from because you might reread what you just sent to them and you see nothing offensive about it, the assumption has to be that there's something called transference in the psychoanalytic literature, and it simply means that you are transferring something in the present to something most likely unresolved from the past that really angered you, that really upset you. And what you're doing is you're reacting to what happened in the past to the person in the present. In other words, they might be redirecting old anger inappropriately toward you. And if that happens, all you can say in return is, you're responding to me as though I said something offensive, or I said something insulting or demeaning or discounting to you. And because that wasn't where I was coming from, I am just wondering whether somehow I got confused with somebody in your past, or whether at least I can clarify what my intention was, because I don't see anything in the language I use that would have led you to respond the way you did. But obviously, you must have heard me that way, and I'm sorry that that happened. In other words, you're kind of validating their experience, but you're not agreeing that they have any right to be angry with you. And you're basically asking them to confront themselves. What led to this reaction? If you look at the language that was used, you'll probably notice that there's nothing there in and of itself that would have been offensive. The problem is you could have inadvertently used a phrase that when, say, their mother used it, it was to tease them. It was to debase them in some way. But it's a tricky situation. You have to have like a PhD in communication to know how to basically respond to them when they're already upset because somehow they misread you.
Yeah, I've run into cases too where I think people have had to be like the good girl or the good boy and had to appear pious, and they were not, and that was kind of co-opted with, I can't have any negative feelings or be angry or anything. And so, it's kind of, I mean, all those feelings are still there. They just are like totally buried. And so then it's sort of this indirect, I'm upset right now, but you're going to have to read my mind and figure out what's wrong and how to fix it. And it's just so hard. It's been so hard to navigate that territory with when things aren't out in the open. And that's what, you know, one of the things about navigating when you're in the middle of relationships that feel like a person isn't brave enough to kind of like just say, is something, and you're saying, is something the matter? And they're saying, no, everything's fine. You're thinking, obviously everything's not fine because this is a really weird conversation. And in your practice, how do you get, like, so for instance, if it's couples or if it's a family or something like that, and there's evasiveness going on, like how do you help people work through some of that?
Well, the first thing I wouldn't do would be to confront them, because that would either guarantee that they would counter-confront me or be archly defensive. So what I would say is, my feeling from what you just said is that I hit a nerve, and my guess is this may be something that happened to you much earlier in life, and this situation might feel the same. In other words, I want to empathize with their feelings, which can be tricky because they may not recognize their feelings. But the main thing is, chances are whatever I will say to them has been said to them by somebody else, that they've heard this before. Now, there's a possibility that they have suppressed the expression of what's really going on. This is why it takes a devious, indirect, passive form. But it's also possible that they've repressed it. So they don't even know that they're coming across in a particular way. So I deal with people who have anger problems. And when they say they're not angry, and they don't know why I would see them as angry, I take them at their word. Very frequently, they grew up in families that were emotionally volatile, and anger was the norm. And unless somebody really screamed at the top of their lungs, that was just business as usual. That was their MO. That was the way things were discussed. So I don't question their reality, but I kind of let them know that if they're misunderstood in the present, it may be because their partner grew up in very different circumstances, and whenever anybody raised their voice at all, that was a cause for some alarm.
Oh, that's really fascinating. You also write that we're all passive aggressive in some cases and at some points. And so how do we go about noticing that in ourselves?
Okay, let me give you the definition of passive aggression that I give in probably my best known article on the subject, which has gotten several hundreds of thousands of views. It's Afraid to Rage, The Origins of Passive Aggressive Behavior. And it makes the point that even babies are naturally assertive. If they're cold, they cry. If they're hungry, they cry. Because they're nonverbal, preverbal, the only way they know to get across their wants and their needs, even if it's simply the need to be held, is to cry. And we have to, of course, read their mind and figure out why they're frustrated. Once we become verbal, if we have parents who are responsive, then we express our thoughts to them directly. We express our feelings directly. Our wants, our needs, we feel free to communicate them. The problem is if we have parents who are very self-absorbed, not responsive at all, and we get the message when we assert our needs that we're being too demanding, that we're being selfish, that we don't deserve whatever it is that we're asking for, or that we're simply not valued, that is incredibly painful to feel that we're only conditionally accepted if we make no requests, no demands, because we're going to be seen negatively as a bother, as an inconvenience, as another mouth to feed, whatever. So what happens is, because of the fear of their response, we hold in our wants and needs. But if we experience our wants and needs as being warranted, after all, there are parents, there are caretakers who are supposed to take care of us. We're terribly dependent on them, whether we want to or not. Then we're going to be angry, because anger comes from the interpretation that what is happening is not fair to us. And you can't think that something is fair and be angry. You're only angry when you think that it's unfair. But afraid to rage means that you have fear that if you are assertive, you'll get bashed, you'll get denied or refused. And if you get angry, the response may be just as bad. In other words, kids do whatever they need to do to secure their bond with their parents. They have to. They're so dependent on their parents. So if, in fact, it's not safe to assert one's wants and needs, then basically they're going to be afraid to. And if it's not safe to tell your parents you're angry with them because you think you deserve what they're not giving you, even if it's even emotional support or reassurance or understanding, then you can't be angry either. So passive aggressiveness is about hiding the fear, hiding the anger, and just having it come out, have it be acted out. In other words, when we're passive aggressive towards somebody else, we're acting out what we can express because we're afraid to rage, and we do have so much anger, but we have so much fear about expressing the anger that it has to come out in an indirect way. And the main thing is, if we repress it, because just experiencing the anger scares us, then if somebody says you're angry, they may not even recognize that they're angry. And again, if you're a layperson, all you can do is intuit that there's something going on with them that you triggered. You're certainly not the source of it, but because they have repressed the trigger, you're being held accountable anyhow. But if you want to open up a dialogue with them, depending on how healthy or not healthy they are, then the first thing you have to do is, well, whatever you're feeling, my guess is from your heart that you really were upset, that you really did feel I offended you. And I want you to know that you're free to talk about what your experience was. And I will tell you, if you listen to me, where I was coming from. I can only talk about my conscious intention, but I know in this particular interaction, I certainly didn't have any spite or malice toward you at all. And yet you seem to have gotten that. And that's why I kind of wonder whether you've had experiences like that in the past. And this seemed just similar enough that you kind of recognized it as something that had happened to you before. And this is what it meant earlier, even though I don't think this is what it means now.
And so how does someone work towards finding that golden mean, or is it just practicing, or what can people keep in mind?
I think, first of all, the individual has to recognize that they have these passive aggressive tendencies. And I know a number of people do, because I've gotten many, many comments on this post and other posts of this nature. And basically, that's the first step. They are aware of it. And then they really need to work through, ideally with a professional, but perhaps by reading good self-help books or by doing a lot of introspection, that their anger toward their parents was justified. And if they've been denying it to themselves, for them to feel the comfort to allow that anger to surface, and even if it means shouting and screaming with the windows closed, hopefully, that there's some way they can vent it. There's some way they can work through it. It's like working through grief. If you deny grief because it emotionally overwhelms you, you can't process it. You can't move forward in your life. And it's the same thing with anger, because the anger has never gone away. It got buried, and yet it can still be triggered by any situation that child inside you somehow sees as a reminder, experiences it somehow as reminiscent of the original refusal of the caretakers, or even maybe the siblings, to be responsive to what your needs were.
You also talk about self-sabotage and passive aggressiveness and how we can do it to ourselves. Could you go into that a little bit?
Well, in terms of being passive aggressive to ourselves, what it suggests is we've got a negative, probably shame-based self-image. And because of that, we don't think we deserve to succeed. It's like snatching defeat from the jaws of victory. If we get close to succeeding and we feel we don't deserve to succeed, or if we succeeded, it would be fraudulent, then we somehow are self-defeating.
And another point you made was this really interesting. I hadn't heard this before, that this term called hostile dependency, and how that can happen in terms of passive aggression and these kind of unhealthy relationship dynamics, and how would that play out. Maybe you could just explain that a little bit. I think, well, I'll have in the show notes links to all your articles relating to passive aggression, and also towards the end of this, soon you can let everybody know where they can find you and your articles. But in terms of hostile dependency, I thought that was a really interesting and fascinating point about what can happen in those situations.
It's actually a fairly common term in the psychotherapeutic literature, and it simply means that we all have a need to have a healthy dependent relationship, but we don't want to be strangled by the relationship. We don't want to experience ourselves as needy, or for the other person to be needy on us. There has to be some balance between autonomy and dependency. Now, the main thing is, if in fact our dependent relationship feels strangulating and keeps us from feeling our autonomy, our independent identity, then we can actually act in a hostile way toward the person who we're dependent on. And this is why it's always important in a relationship not to crowd your partner.
And yeah, I had thought of it maybe in terms of a child and a parent or something, a teenager or something like that. I have a 16-year-old son, and he has some special needs, but in many ways, he's a very normal 16-year-old, and he wants to be as independent as he can be, of course, like a typical teenager. But in terms of an adult relating to another adult in just trying to have a healthy relationship, but then feeling hostility in ways because of dysfunction or something like that, I guess it just, I hadn't thought of it in those terms as I was reading in your article, and it was really, I don't know, it was just really interesting. Maybe just the way it was phrased or the way it was put, I got a lot out of that.
The term I like to use that seems to connect to so much of this is simply the term, the notion of trust. If in fact you learn to distrust others because your parents betrayed your trust, they would promise you something and they wouldn't deliver. And then when you reminded them what they promised, they said, oh, you're just being selfish. It's possible that they promised it when they were under the influence or something like that. But if you learn to distrust because your parents were not trustworthy, what that means is you're going to have a problem with intimacy, because getting too close to others when you have these basic unresolved trust issues is going to make you anxious. And this is why one reason that people get angry is to moderate the emotional distance between themselves and the other person. So the important thing is to realize that there's going to be hostility if, in fact, there isn't enough distance because the person is threatened. Because being too close to somebody means you could get rejected, you could be made to feel unloved, and it's scary. So it all comes down to the fact that you have trust issues, and it doesn't matter whether your partner or a close friend has inspired you to distrust them. They may have given you no reason to distrust them, but all you know is you needed to protect yourself from your parents or you could really be hurt. You could feel excessively vulnerable. And that became sort of an emotional survival technique that just generalized or universalized to everybody else.
Yeah, as we get closer in our relationships, there is vulnerability there, and we stand to lose or get hurt or something like that. And really, in a way, people can't be trusted in the sense that they will fail us because they're humans too, you know. And so there is, I guess, can feel like a mounting risk, and then you can do things that will maybe sabotage it, maybe purposefully, or maybe unconsciously, or maybe a little of both. That makes sense.
I think it's mostly unconscious. The fact is that we all want intimate connections. That is, I think, universal. And yet some people fight it because they're afraid they will lose themselves, they will be engulfed. That's another aspect of it. What we're talking about is so intricate because there's so many dimensions to it. But the main thing is, let's say you had a mom who was living through you, wanted to be your best friend, wanted to dress like you dress, because I've had clients who, just to be different from their mom, got a different hairdo from their mom. And then their mom turned around and got the same hairdo. And that's pretty sick stuff. But what that means is you're afraid of closeness, because your experience of closeness was over closeness, and you need to be independent. And it's very hard to find the right balance, because you don't want to be too far away from the person you may love. At the same time, when they get close, it feels endangering to you.
And is that where ambivalence plays in? Could you help define that a little bit?
Well, ambivalence literally means of two minds about something. And what you're right. You're absolutely right, because what it means is your interests conflict with one another. So to put it in the simplest way possible, if you have a need to be independent and you have need to be close, and those needs aren't somehow integrated with one another, then you waffle, you go back and forth. And it's very confusing to the other person, because your reasoning really doesn't make any sense to them. And it's basically you're just rationalizing something that you're not even aware of. So if somebody's afraid of intimacy because that parent was too close, or because to try to be intimate was to make oneself excessively vulnerable, then it doesn't matter how you behave toward your partner. Unless they resolve that issue, that conflict is going to keep coming up, because, as you use the term, they're ambivalent about how close they feel they can afford to be.
And I guess the first step in rectifying that or getting through some of that is just kind of being aware of your own feelings and your own ambivalence, just coming to a reckoning with that. Or how do you suggest people take some first steps?
Well, if they're able to develop the awareness simply by honestly looking back at their parents' deficiencies and in the present do reality checks to say to themselves, wait a minute, that was then, this is now, let me get reality centered. A wonderful example of this, although it goes in a totally different direction, is of a therapist whose specialty was dealing with children who had been molested. Actually, adults who had been molested as children. And he himself had been molested by his priest when he was an altar boy. And he was asked to give a speech or talk to the congregation in Catholic Church. And he was being introduced by a priest. And all of a sudden, his whole body was just quaking. He was just shaking with nervousness. And he realized in the moment that he was sort of having a flashback. And he was seeing this priest as the priest who molested him. And once he made the connection and said, oh, no, this priest understands, I've spoken to him before, then he was able to calm himself down. So when you're aware that it's coming up for me again, and you have some awareness that the person may have triggered it, but they didn't really say anything that put you in any kind of emotional danger, then you can get back to the present. But in order to do that, you first would have had to do, I would think, some significant work on your altering your perspective by processing what happened to you in the past. Remember, most passive-aggressive people have never processed through this. They've just suppressed it all, and they don't have that awareness. So, in other words, as a therapist, I try to, in the safest way possible, let them experience the original vulnerability that they had to protect themselves from, and make the office that I work with them in a safe space so they can feel that vulnerability and have me safeguard it for them.
Yeah, as we're talking, I'm thinking about the many ways that passive aggression comes out that are so ordinary, like even just sarcasm or gossip or these other ways to triangulation and these other ways that it can come out that are less than direct toward dealing with an issue or a person or relationship in more straightforward ways. And really, once you start taking an inventory, you're like, well, you know, when I did that, that was not really that upfront. your life can be full of those little pockets that are not really, that probably should be examined for, you know, why am I doing that, or what am I afraid of? And I think that we stand to gain a lot by getting more aware of our behaviors instead of reacting and maybe taking a closer look.
I also have written an article, I think it was called Your Ego, Should It Be Strengthened or Shrunk? And I make the distinction between a big ego, which is an artificially inflated ego, but can easily be punctured because it's big, like you blow up a balloon is big, and a strong ego. And a strong ego is an ego that can take criticism, that can look at oneself, rather than to project back onto the person who may have accused him or her of not being so nice, to say, well, you know, you're the one who's not nice, or something like that. Now, the main thing is to do the kind of introspection that I think you're suggesting takes a certain strength of ego. And somebody who has, in other words, what is paradoxical is that weak egos are not generally associated with big egos, but it's actually one and the same thing. In other words, it's just a way of compensating for a weak ego, which means a kind of deficient sense of self, by posturing, by boasting, by feigning superiority over other people.
Yeah, because there you sense the deficiency, so you have to compensate, and that's also artificial.
Yeah, and that's where most narcissism comes from.
Ah, yeah. And would you say with narcissism, there's just a lack of self-knowledge there too?
Not always. There actually are some narcissists that know that they're narcissists, and if anything, are proud of being narcissists, but that is the minority. Mostly,
that sounds more psychotic, but obviously I'm speaking out of complete ignorance there. But if somebody is reveling in their narcissism, is that more of a psychopathy?
Well, it is interesting because narcissism has a number of elements that are common to sociopathy. Because, for instance, one of the features of narcissism is a sense of entitlement. In other words, I'm superior, so I'm entitled to break the law, to extend it in different ways. And sociopaths also lack empathy, because narcissists are notoriously empathy challenged. So it's not that big a jump from narcissism to sociopathy. The other thing that links them is they both have anger problems, because narcissists generally have a lot of anger because they didn't get what they needed when they were growing up in terms of support and validation and empathy. And as a result of that, they're angry. And a lot of them pretty much come from anger. This is why narcissists frankly, when they abuse their wives, they kind of feel good when they make their wives cry. They don't really feel guilty at all.
Because it's they had it coming and they kind of get what they deserve.
Well, it's sort of like passive aggression. You're acting against somebody who is not the cause of your original frustration, but they're there. So, and the problem with acting out against somebody who didn't really cause you the grief to begin with is it doesn't help it move toward resolution at all. It does the opposite.
Wow. Wow, there's so much in here. Would you mind coming back on the show at another time, maybe in the new year?
I'd be happy to.
I would love it because it feels like we're just getting started, but I want to be respectful of your time, and this has been such a pleasure. I'm very grateful that you would come on.
I just hope the recording comes out.
Me too. You're not the only one. Where could people find your work and maybe on social media or a website like that where they could find out more about you?
If they just put my name down, Leon Seltzer, S-E-L-T-Z-E-R, and then add Psychology Today, the first page will have, I think probably it will start with my blog page or my, bio page. But if they really want to see what articles I may have written that they could get something from, then the main thing is simply to go to my blog site. And it will just have page after page of the different articles I've written, and each one will have attached to it maybe the first paragraph, so they'll have a sense of what I'm dealing with in that particular article.
Right. And you, I think it was, you write Evolution of Self.
Right. In other words, I'm glad you added that. In other words, on the first page, it should say after Leon F. Seltzer, Evolution of the Self. That is the name of my blog. So if you click on that, then you'll be directed to my blog site.
Mm, good. Okay. That's great. Thank you so much. I really appreciate this, Dr. Seltzer.
Okay. Glad to be on.
Don't forget to check out sparkmymuse.com where there's show notes to this episode and every episode with related links and photos and all kinds of extra goodies. But I also want to ask a special favor too. Please donate $5 or $10 to the show. It's listener supported. It makes a very big difference when you help out. Another thing that helps out is a rating or review on iTunes and spreading the word with friends and family. Please help the show survive, and thank you so much for listening.